Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to this Statesman's Forum. I'm Stephen Flanagan, Senior Vice President here at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, and it's a delight to welcome back to CSIS Prime Minister Mirek Topolánek of the Czech Republic, and also with him Ambassador Kola, a distinguished representative of the Czech Republic here, and the rest of the Prime Minister's entourage. The Prime Minister comes to us in the midst of a busy schedule here in Washington. He's been moving around town, making his way meetings with, as you may know, with a number of cabinet members here and with leaders of Congress, where he's off to this afternoon. And we were delighted that he could make some time to come here to share with us his views on European Czech view on challenges in Euro-Atlantic security. Let me just make a few remarks about his biography to remind you of his career, and then we'll turn to his remarks. Mirek Topolánek was born in Vlissin, in the Zlin area of central, what historic central and eastern Moravia. Before getting into politics, like a lot of people of his generation, he had a different career, a career in engineering and in enterprise management. He was trained as an engineer, first in Brno University in mechanical engineering, and then on to other training in management. And he began in a variety of positions in the 80s in project engineering and in mining and other enterprises before, of course, that siren call of 1989 came, with many people moved by a civic forum and the desire suddenly that politics in the then Czechoslovakia, of course, got a lot more interesting. And so he became active in civic forum in 1989, a member of the Civic Democratic Party since 1994, and a member of first in local government and then in the Senate and as a member of parliament in the Czech Republic, where he went on to become vice chairman of the Committee on National Economy, Agriculture, and Transport. A member also of the Committee on National Economy, then in 2002-2004, vice chairman of the Senate of the Parliament, and elected to the leadership of his party, the ODS, in 2002, and finally assuming his current duties as Prime Minister of the Czech Republic in September of 2006. He has had a number of distinguished awards and serves on a number of boards. He's been active in both various educational boards and in aspects of European Atlantic cooperation, and he confided into me that, as we might have suspected of any good Czech, he has strong interest in hockey, and he was happy to have a chance to partake of a visit to the Verizon Center and watch the Caps take on was it the Minnesota North Stars, I guess he said. So at least that part of his agenda has been fulfilled here. So we are delighted to welcome Minister Topolánek to the platform. He will speak in English, and then after his remarks are finished, we will take some questions. He will questions can be made in English, but as you all have earpieces, we will allow him to give his responses in Czech. So, Mr. Topolánek, welcome, and look forward to your remarks.
Thank you very much for introduction. It was a very speed career. I listened, and it was very interesting. Let me at first to thank you for invitation to this institution, and allow me present my view to security problems in Central Europe and Europe generally. Allow me to add a subtitle to the headline of my presentation: Why Security Challenges in Central Europe Still Matter. Is Cold War Reloaded? I purposely chose rather a provocative subtitle for my talk. You may have read a similar kind of titles in the Czech newspapers, but without the question mark. Why? The current security policy debate in the Czech Republic is marked by the discussion on the stationing of the American missile defense premises in Central Europe and its geopolitical and strategic consequences. The content of my presentation here today, as you may have already guessed, is going to be in contrast with the title. I would like to show you that such kind of headlines are nothing more than the good work of Russian PR experts who know that journalists will be happy to catch any sharp slogan. The basic reason why anti-missile system doesn't mean the return of the Cold War is that the system is a response to a new security challenge after an era of rivalry between two blocs. It addresses another threat, differently defined and where the enemies are more hidden. You cannot have a Cold War if the antagonist of the Cold War is missing. That thinking is a logical mistake. It is a case of contradictione adjecto, a contradiction. Nomen omen, self-fulfilling prophecy. In this case, is 100% true for the anti-missile defense. The system from the time of the Cold War was named SDI, Strategic Defense Initiative. The missing word strategic clearly suggests that both the aim and the philosophy on the anti-missile defense have been revised. Today's anti-missile umbrella has very little in common with the ambitious Star Wars project President Reagan embraced, except that it also excites valiant criticism. Both here in the United States and in Europe, where its effectiveness is especially challenged, the European and Russian politicians accuse it, unjustly, I believe, of calling upon the spirit of the Cold War. There is a significant difference between the criticism of 20 years ago and that of today. The Soviet Union and its European satellites protested against SDI right from the very beginning. The Soviets knew well that this technologically demanding and expensive project represented a threat of strategic significance. Concerning the anti-missile defense, Moscow was keeping silent as long as the systems elements were being installed on US territory or in Western Europe. It was only when the radar site in the Czech Republic and the interceptors in Poland started to be considered that the propagandistic machinery began firing rounds. This makes it clear that it is poorly purpose-oriented criticism, further evidenced by the fact that Russia itself is building similar systems. The criticism is not addressed so much to the government of the United States as towards swaying public opinion in European countries. Therefore, the strong media rhetoric. Therefore, too, the entire range of activities funded by Russia, which focus on planning of the emotion of citizens. The aim is to bring about fear. Fear that because of the anti-missile system, the Czech Republic and Poland will become targets of terrorists. Fear of Russian revenge. Fear of the power whims of the US. It needs to be admitted that this cocktail mixed from appeasement, pacifism, and anti-Americanism is working. And it is hard to face down because media in the free world is a tool of criticism, not of explanations. These are, however, poorly political problems, and it is upon us to be able to deal with them. I would like to focus on the wider safety discourse, which is outside the scope of the anti-missile defense, the physical and philosophical confines. No matter how many questions the anti-missile umbrella may justly inspire, we must not forget that this is only a means by which to reach a goal, not the goal itself, and that there surely must be another way leading to the same goal. As a politician responsible for the contingent installation of the anti-missile shield of the territory of the Czech Republic, I carefully followed the debate which is being carried out in the United States. Points of view like functionality, effectiveness, concerning de-elimination of potential threats, cause and integration into NATO structures, all of these will be vital in the decision-making process of the Czech government and the parliament. I do not, however, want to talk about this today. As I have said, the anti-missile defense is only a means a part of the security policy, not the security policy itself. It is, however, a highly advanced technology, and modern technologies do somehow influence and change our behavior and actions. The security policy naturally changed after the end of the Cold War. Instead of two more or less equal and clearly defined blocks, we are now facing asymmetric, more dimensional threats which have been caused by substate or transnational players. Even during the Cold War, it was understood that victory cannot be brought about solely by military means. And although the Soviet bloc was arms raced up in the end and defeated, especially thanks to SDI, democracy could come about only because of the existence of dissident structures who were ready to take over the power and launch the transformation of the totalitarian system. The support of the West of democratic opposition and its enforcement of the Helsinki process were significant for speeding up the internal erosion of the system and for the ability to build democratic institutions, preventing the return of totalitarianism. Of course, everything was easier because even after 40 years of communism, the countries of Central and Eastern Europe have never ceased to belong to the Western civilization, and thus they had something to return to and to build upon. Today's situation is different. The significance of non-military soft force needed for the victory of liberal democracy, and especially for its maintenance, has not decreased. But the way to apply it is more complicated. The disadvantage is that democratic institutions usually do not have a tradition in the countries where the terrorist threats originate. The advantage, on the other hand, is that unlike the countries of the Soviet bloc, which were tightly closed against any institutional influence from outside, these cases are different. Thus, we have a chance to participate in the building of democratic and civic institutions. And in the cases of Iraq and Afghanistan, we even have the responsibility for their foundation and operation. If anything is failing, it is not military operations, but the ability to build democratic institutions and working civic administration, to introduce the rule of law and order, and to ensure citizen safety. It is a long and difficult process, but we must go through it. Otherwise, our military victories will turn against us. I follow the debate on foreign policy within the American presidential race, and I dare say that the reflection on a balanced use of hard power, military force, coercion, and soft power, civil force, persuasion, fully reflect the change in the security and strategic environment. We understand the anti-missile umbrella to be a part of greater politics, which is far from being purely military. This is yet another denial of the Cold War mentality, which practically excluded any civil cooperation. Threats which we have to face in the era after the Cold War are different. But the question which we must answer in order to efficiently eliminate them remains the same. First, we must correctly designate the threats. Second, we must be able to analyze them. Third, we must be determined to achieve victory. Fourth, we must be persistent to maintain the new status quo. The terrorism itself is nothing new, but it gains completely new dimensions in the world after the Cold War, when the iron bands of the bloc system fell apart. It is no longer an isolated phenomenon, whether in space or time. It is turning into a permanent global campaign, owing to modern communication means. Contrary to ideologically motivated terrorism of the Cold War, The identity of today's terrorism is formed by the extreme and violent jihadism. It is much more malign, especially because it does not fear self-destruction and is thus irrational and unpredictable. It is also more persistent and determined than the communism because it draws force directly from cultural roots. Global terrorism has no central authority. It does not need great military forces, massive employment of machinery and complicated logistics. It's mobile, strictly decentralized, and highly conspiracy motivated. Terrorists do not have their own state, although some countries do support terrorism, and therefore they must count with revenge. Terrorism utilizes ethnical, tribal, and sectarian conflicts and points of frictions at the encounter of civilization. This gives it new recruits, and at the same time provides it with a base on ideal cover. The security issue is further complicated by a rise on new powers whose regimes are as hostile and unpredictable as the terrorists. And the fact that they are going to behave pragmatically, like Soviet Moscow used to, cannot be relied on. On the other hand, many states are falling apart and get divided according to ethnic or religious differences, which creates another hotbed for terrorism. Based upon this brief designation of the threat, I can see the differences between the present time and the Cold War. There is no deterrent force which would keep the terrorists tamed. On the contrary, during the Cold War, the West eliminated Soviet dominance in conventional arms by a more powerful strike arsenal. Today's situation is reversed. The terrorists can negate our military dominance by threatening to employ arms of mass destruction against civilians. There is no clearly divided time of peace and time of war. Borders between them get blurred. Tension is permanent and violence can break out any time. And the nature of military operations must reflect this. It puts new demands on strategic planning, on reforming armed forces, and on employment of army units. There is no solution in solely defeating the opponent. The arising conflicts are usually long-term. Peace is difficult to achieve, and fights are easy to start over. And even in cases where an effective military victory is possible, it is only the beginning of a journey which doesn't end with a defeated country, but with a working democratic society. It's clear that the significance of the connection of military, civic, and economic forces doesn't diminish, but rises. It is also necessary to carefully consider the employment of forces and the division of risks, not to get exhausted in non-effective operations and not to uselessly create new threats. Light relationships, which not only assist with military operations, but more importantly, widen the potential of the soft force, gain a special meaning. The threats of the 21st century are different from those during the Cold War. One of them is an attack by individual ballistic missiles launched from the territory of one of those unpredictable regimes or by one of those sub-state players. The anti-missile umbrella in its present form does not change the strategic balance of forces, but it is a response to one particular threat. A response which comes after the designation and analysis of the risk and is an expression of our determination to face it. I like to stress again that we do not consider the anti-missile system to be the final response, not even from the military point of view, let alone from the civil one. The Czech Republic is aware that new threats require new approaches to prevent them. Therefore, we positively reacted to the offer of placing anti-missile defense elements on the Czech territory. We have four main reasons to enter the negotiations about the system. First, we see it as a manifestation of confidence in the Czech Republic, which has proved to be a competent ally, including joint missions, and which is able to undertake new tasks for the joint defense. Second, we see it as a manifestation of our will to honor these commitments today and any time in the future, as a payment of our debt which incurred when we were accepted to NATO. We want to be a country which not only uses the defense of others, but which actively partakes on the defense of the Euro-Atlantic area. The complex anti-missile defense system will also provide protection for advanced American troops and allies. Third, there is a geostrategic aspect. If there are two defense sections created within NATO, a section with the defense system and a section without it, the alliance would then become diffused and its unity broken. There would be first-class countries and second-class countries as far as security is concerned. In the anti-missile defense elements are not built in Poland and the Czech Republic, and the United States goes on without us. We would perceive it as a risk. Therefore, we strive that there is a comprehensive united anti-ballistic missile defense system within NATO. Last but not least, the anti-missile defense has a geopolitical significance. Central Europe has always been an object of struggle of world powers. Many conflicts have arisen here in the past, which also affected other countries, including the World War II. Russia, which is refining its power ambitions, dislikes its having vacated this region. The failure of the anti-missile defense project would undoubtedly strengthen the pressure which Russia exerts upon the region and would move us closer to the sphere of Russia's influence. I shall dwell more in detail on the specific relationship between the anti-missile defense and security challenges in Central Europe. As I have said, in the course of past centuries, this region has been vital for world security and remains so. Whenever there was a power vacuum in Central Europe, the world powers had a tendency to fill it, which led to many wars. And on the contrary, the stability of the region contributed to the security of entire Europe. Now Central Europe is a part of the zone of stability and security, NATO. Any casting of doubts, any weakening of the role of Central European countries as full right members of the alliance uselessly creates new risks and threats. Of course, the anti-missile defense project is a confirmation of the region's security position and thus contributes to world stability. I point out that I do not specifically mean the anti-missile umbrella now. It does not exist and other defense systems are built instead. We would also like to be a part of them together with Western Europe. Whether to station the anti-missile defense elements or not on our soil, that must be our sovereign decision made while concerning our own security interests and commitments to our allies. Of course, we need to maintain a dialogue with Russia, and we do so, like the US government, but we cannot let the anti-missile defense system be partially decided in Moscow. That would mean the return of Cold War mentality, of rivalry, of two powers, of principle of revenge and deterrence. The anti-missile defense does react to particular security threats. For us, however, the primary focus is anchoring of values of Central European region within the Euro-Atlantic area. The one for all for one principle, which was the basis of the Washington Treaty, has more significant meaning than the military one. The alliance has been more than the community of defense since its beginning. It has been a safeguard of common values. It it does not only represent the most powerful military force in the world. That is not the goal, but a means for the defense of liberal democracy. Alliance's hard military force always served to one goal, the defense of the soft force of civic society. We do not underestimate the potential threat of an attack by ballistic missiles, but the basic significance for us at the negotiations about the anti-missile system is the non-military scope. It is a political decision expressing an allegiance to civilization and a unified will to defend ourselves. Central Europe, Europe, and NATO need this unity. The threat of the terrorist attack by arms of mass destruction is significant. However, it is only part of the issue, which is also suggested by an increased activity of intelligence agencies in the region. In the future, we will need to proceed together in a unified manner, not only at preventing terrorist threats, but also at enforcing energy security, solving migration issues, strengthening democracy in the world and providing foreign aid, addressing issues of war trade and closer economic cooperation. One of the benefits which we hope the anti-missile defense would bring is the transfer of top technologies and scientific, research and industrial cooperation. In short, the development of the soft civil environment which the anti-missile umbrella should protect. And the circle closes. The anti-missile system is not only a result of the will to maintain a united Euro-Atlantic area, but at the same time it brings more reasons why this unity has sense. I could summarize my opinion on the relationship between Central Europe and the anti-missile defense into one sentence. The question is not why the elements of anti-missile defense should be installed here, but why they should not be. Why not if the system is functional and works well in other NATO countries, NATO countries? And this brings me to the end and to the final answer to the question. Does the anti-missile defense system mean a return of the Cold War? I can briefly recapitulate the reason why I believe that it doesn't. The antagonist from the Cold War is missing. The system is a response to new threats. The anti-missile umbrella is a part of a wider, not only military, politics, and its final goal is not competition, but cooperation and aid to countries where terrorists have their bases. The anti-missile system is of a predominantly defensive nature. It does not change the strategic balance of the forces, but responds to one particular threat. The elements of the anti-missile defense in Central Europe are an expression of overcoming the Cold War mentality. Failure of this project, however, would encourage revisionist efforts and de facto drop a new iron curtain, this time across the NATO countries. With your permission, I would end my talk with a question mark. Why does an anti-missile defense system in Central Europe stir up such passionate response while there are large American bases including anti-missile defense elements and employing thousands of soldiers functioning with no problems in the rest of the continent? Why does the criticism always vary from military and technical parameters and possibilities of the system? Is this not the best proof that we are on the right track? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Prime Minister. We will now have ample time for questions. I would just ask you to please identify yourself, and then we'll have a simultaneous translation here, so that the speak slowly, so that we can have a good translation and make sure that your intent is clear. So, And let me also just welcome a couple of the members of the diplomatic corps that I hadn't noted earlier. First of all, Ambassador Kacher from the Slovak Republic, who's sitting in the front row, and the Deputy Chief of Mission, Daniela Gitman, from the Romanian Embassy. And there may be others. I'm sorry. I was blinded by the light here when I came in. I couldn't see. But I think there was a question in the middle here. Yes, sir. And wait for the microphone, please.
Zaleski from the Polish Press Agency in Washington. Mr. Prime Minister, before you arrived here, you had said that your government would coordinate your moves. Sorry. Tomasz Zalewski, Polish Press Agency. Mr. Prime Minister, before you arrived here, you had said that your government would coordinate your moves on the anti-missile shield with the Polish government. Does it mean that in case Poland doesn't finalize its agreement with the United States on its part system, and the negotiations are still ongoing, as you know, doesn't mean that the Czech government will delay also the finalizing agreement with the United States?
Thank you very much for your question. I am certainly consulting all of these matters with Donald Tusk, and we are on the phone constantly and permanently. However, let me make a difference between a negotiated contract and a contract signed. We will certainly want to sign the agreements on the same date or around the same date as the Polish side. The fact that at this moment we're a little bit ahead of the Polish side, that's our advantage, but that does not change anything on the importance of concluding those negotiations together. I personally think that the Polish side is very close to arriving to the conclusion, and the package of requirements and conditions that they're staking should not be directly related to the stationing of the interceptors in the Polish soil. Modernization of the Polish army is not directly related to the stationing of the interceptors on the soil, on the Polish soil. Therefore, I am not afraid that we would get into a situation in which the Polish side would not be able to timely conclude the negotiations, and that we would not be able to NATOize, i.e. to put this whole missile defense system under the umbrella of NATO at the Bucharest summit.
Middle of the side. You could just wait for the microphone, please.
Georgia Daposho, CSIS. What is the actual state of bilateral negotiations with Washington?
As you probably know, there are two basic agreements. We usually refer to it as the Greater Agreement and Smaller Agreement, NATO SOFA. And as far as the Greater Agreement, we've practically arranged for all the details. There's actually one outstanding point still pending to be resolved. However, it is a technical issue. It relates to the protection of environment, natural environment. And we actually agree on the principle that we should follow the legislation on environmental protection, which is stricter. So it is actually to be decided which legislation is kind of tougher or stricter, and they're actually just three or four words that we have to fine-tune, but I'm sure that within a few coming weeks we're going to finalize it. As far as the NATO SOFA agreement, the smaller agreement or the minor agreement, we've not reached that far in terms of the greater agreement, but we're moving ahead. This contract this agreement is not so important as the greater one, but we're going to work on it further, and it will take a few more months to finalize it, and I do not envisage any major problems on the way. As far as the Polish side is concerned, I can't really answer you from the top of my head. I don't have so much detailed information on this, so this answer relates only to the Czech side. Let me actually add on this note that I'm not, but we should differentiate this process from the ratification and signing of this agreement, because the agreements have to be signed by the president and also they have to be ratified by the parliament, so there's a long way ahead of us.
Questions on the missile defense issue? It looks like there is one in the back, perhaps.
Yes, hello. I'm Susan Cornwell with Reuters. Will you put your missile defense agreement before your parliament for its approval? And how soon do you expect to do that? And secondly, what will the radar cost that's going into the Czech Republic, and who's going to pay the bill? Thank you.
Já myslel účet za telefony, které byly, který byl vystaven při vyjednání.
Well, you're asking about bills or payment of the bills. First of all, we should think about paying the telephone bills, because there have been a number of telephone calls to arrange and negotiate this agreement. So, first of all, the cabinet should approve this agreement and then it should be presented to the parliament. It is exactly the same way as you would do it in the United States of America. I can't envisage any other way. But permanently, we're in touch with the parliamentary members, communicate with the parliamentary committees and we update them on the development of the negotiations about various aspects, about studies, feasibility studies, impact studies on the environment. We're talking about various other studies regarding the health impact on the population. We're talking about negotiations with Russia, NRC or bilateral related. So the parliament has been up till now very well informed. The moment it is signed and approved by the cabinet, it will be presented to our parliament, to the two chambers of our parliament. There'll be the reading rounds, and pursuant to our legislation and constitution, this these agreements should be approved. And as far as the financing and funding of this, well, we should not realize that this is not the first military base ever built by the United States in Europe. There are 14 nations or 14 countries which host American equipment, American sites, so we should not really pretend that this is a different case. So it will follow the same pattern, and the American side is going to pay for the whole investment. So, of course, the details have to be precised in those individual contracts in relation to the respective countries, but the model is the same. The model is the same.
Carolyn Persuti with Voice of America TV. Welcome, Prime Minister, first of all. And during the briefing after your meeting with President Bush, you mentioned that there were three words that kept you apart from the agreement, and now we hear there is one point. Can you elaborate on that? And also, what is the next step? Would this involve another meeting with the President and another visit to the United States?
Well, I think I have already provided as much detail as I actually originally wanted or intended, but these three words or these outstanding issues only relate to the environmental regulations, and we, I think, found common language and we agreed that we will use the stricter environmental norms and standards. I obviously didn't want to tackle this issue on the phone, and that's why I have to go back to Prague to finalize this issue, but there's nothing serious, I assure you. My trip to the United States has been often presented by the media as for the purpose of arranging the missile defense system, its stationing in the Czech Republic, and exchange of this missile defense system for the visa waiver program. But I think there is a more important purpose of my visit, and that is the promotion of human rights or protection of human rights. I met the dissidents from various countries, from Iran, from Cuba, Belarus, Burma, and I met a number of our immigrants, a number of Czechs living in the United States, so I don't think that we should limit my trip or its significance only to the missile defense negotiations. I think that the memorandum of understanding on the visa waiver program has got much wider implications and ramifications. Hopefully, we'll be able to also gain access to research and development in the field of military defense system. So all of these are added values to my trip, but that's definitely not the main purpose of my visit or my trip to the United States of America.
Close out on this missile defense question, one other point, which is I wonder if you could give us a sense of what impact the national intelligence estimate on the Iranian nuclear program has had on the internal Czech debate about deployment of the X-band radar, and in particular the question of the timing as to how that should proceed, and what is your government's current position on when the initial construction work should begin or how it should unfold, and what consultation process should exist with other countries that have expressed concerns about this?
Well, first of all, I would like to say that following the feasibility study that was approved in Riga during the NATO summit, there is another study being carried out regarding the various threats based on which we are basing this program on defense against short, middle-range, and long-range missiles. And this study clearly shows that the threats identified are even bigger than we thought, or at least we realize that there'll be many more threats. It's not just about Iran. It's not only about the countries which today are capable of devising such weapons. But I tried to actually explain during my presentation that there are also countries who could take hold on these weapons, or maybe these might not be even countries. It might be organizations, groups. So it would be funny to claim that we are building the system against Russia or any particular country. We're actually building this to defend ourselves against any dangers appearing in the past. And I think our objective in this enterprise should be to devise this missile defense system in collaboration with Russia and also under the NATO umbrella. As far as the practical implementation details are concerned, I don't think that neither of the sides would give you any specific dates, because first, the ratification process has to take place. Without ratification, we can't continue and even think further. It is not possible to get any further budgets from the United States Congress unless this program is ratified. So we know how much time is needed. We know how much time will be needed from the moment of decision, how much finances would be needed, but the date itself and the practicalities regarding let's say the originally announced date we should be able to fulfill it.
I'll come back over here. Yes, sir, in the second row.
Mr. Prime Minister, if you permit me, my question will be from a different kettle. The day before yesterday saw a very sad anniversary. 60 years of the communist putsch in Czechoslovakia. And we know what followed. 40 years of terror, oppression, brainwashing. And yet, Mr. Prime Minister, there is a substantial part of the Czech nation that vote communist again. Shouldn't we be worried about that? What is the danger that the Communist Party will eventually get a foot in the door and get in the government? Can you perhaps take a position on this? Thank you.
Well, that's, I think, a topic which would deserve a full-fledged talk on its own right. However, today we are commemorating, a few days ago we commemorated this very sad anniversary. Number 8 plays a very important, almost, you might say, fatal role in our history. Number 8 appears in some of the most important dates of the Czech Republic's or Czechoslovakia's history. 1918, Czechoslovak Republic was founded by Tomáš Garrigue Masaryk with the assistance of Woodrow Wilson in 1938. Unfortunately, with the Americans on our side, the Munich Agreement was signed between England and France and Hitler in 1948. It is the mentioned coup d'etat by the communists. 1968, we were invaded by the Russians. Of course, there are always debates. Should Edvard Beneš, our president then, should he accept the demise of his ministers or not? Could the coup d'etat of the communists have been avoided efficiently or not? 1968, I've mentioned already, it is the Prague Spring time, Prague Spring period, and the following occupation. So number 8 really plays an important role in our history. In 1991, the 30th of June, 1991, that's not very long time ago, it was in 1991 when the last Soviet soldiers left the soil of the Czech Republic. If you really consider all these historical implications and aspects, then you will readily realize how important these things are important for us. So now there is 26 MPs in our parliament represent the Communist Party, but that is an improvement, because originally, I think 1 or 2 years ago, it was only 40. Obviously, there is a group of old people, pensioners, who still commemorate those communist times, but unfortunately there's also a new generation of people growing up in the Czech Republic, which is now enjoying prosperity and relative leisure and easy life. And these people again dream about equality. They dream about those ideals which are at the grassroots of the communist thinking. And as the communists wanted to command wind and rain, that was one of the slogans of the communists in the 50s, you still see some of these ramifications today, be it the environmental movement, be it the efforts to combat the climate change. So I think that is always a risk of history repeating itself. Therefore, in the parliament, we pushed through the establishment of something similar to the Glocks Institute, an institute which researches on the horrors of the totalitarian regimes. And this institution should be here as a living memory of the crimes of communism, and we believe that it is our obligation to live to leave this to the posteriority of our I think you know, we should be able to draw on these examples to learn our lesson of history, to show how democracy, how fragile can democracy be, and that freedom is not for free. So obviously, democracy, freedom, those are very nice flowers, but they need to be watered in order to flourish. And it is a never-ending battle, it is a never-ending struggle, it is a never-ending story. You always have to go forward, you always have to defend those values, you have to combat and resist various attacks on and attempts on freedom and democracy. Thank you very much for this question, because I think it very well fits into the scope and significance of my trip to the US. And for me, the missile defense system is yet another important step, which in its importance can be compared to those which have number 8 in their year, in their date.
Moya Rush Today TV. First of all, thank you, and I would like to go back to missile defense, actually. We had a chance to speak to Joel Sirincione. He's a senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. And this is what he said, quote, "Neither the Czech Republic nor Poland want to say no to the United States, but they also don't want to say yes. So it's what we call slow rolling. They're talking about it, They're indicating they might be able to get a deal, but there will be no deal. In fact, he went on to say that after the Bush administration is over, the United States will completely drop the idea of a missile defense shield in Eastern Europe.
I think that this is wishful thinking. I don't want to disappoint you, but it's wishful thinking. I think that there is a certain there's a certain misconception of who really lost the Cold War. I don't think it was neither the Americans nor the Russians who lost the Cold War. Communists and the communist regime lost the Cold War, and that is a great chance for Russia. And I'm an optimist. I believe that Russia, especially in terms of those values that they can agree on with the US, which is the mass destruction, weapons proliferation, and other issues, I think I'm sure that they will be able to find common language at the end of the day with US on the missile defense issue. Because I think that, you know, it is for the benefit of Russia, because this will not allow Russia to be blackmailed by those rogue states. It doesn't really make any logic. It doesn't give any logic for Russia to refuse the system. The only logic I find behind that is a kind of geopolitical fight for Central Europe. I would like to recommend you to read the energy policy issued by the Russian Federation in 2003. Then you will understand some of the worries and concerns of countries like the Czech Republic, worries that we might once more again fall under the influence of Russia. We want Russians to enjoy democracy, and we want Russians to cooperate with us on building a system which is going to defend our people. That's all.
Just quickly, if you...
Do you feel like you're stuck in the middle, you and Poland, the Czech Republic and Poland, like you're stuck in the middle between Russia and the United States? And we know that Poland, I don't want to say afraid, but there are some concerns that Russia said that they will not exclude the possibility of a preemptive attack to defend their territorial integrity. So, and some experts that we've spoken to also said that the Czech Republic and Poland are kind of feel that they're stuck in the middle. How difficult of a decision this is?
Well, I just tried to explain who, in my opinion, the losers are in terms of the Cold War. I don't think that the Russian Federation is the loser in the Cold War conflict. When you actually study some of the rhetoric of some of those generals, well, of course, if some generals say things which are beyond any logic, then you can find the same example everywhere in the world. But I do not think that we should really believe in it, and we should actually take it on its face value. And I think that this rhetoric is very much the same rhetoric as the Cold War rhetoric. But let me actually continue in my answer. I'm not afraid that we would not be able to strike the deal with the Americans and finalize the process. The only worry I might have is that we will not be able to ratify the process. But I'll do all my best so that this process, or so that this agreement, is ratified by our parliament. To be even more specific, for me, the presence of Americans in the Czech Republic is a guarantee of security of the whole region. Even if it is only if it takes one American soldier, I think it is the guarantee of security in our area. Thank you very much for your question, indeed.
Yes, I'm Mary Birdman from AER in Germany. There is a very rapid movement to have the Lisbon Treaty ratified throughout Europe, although the fact, of course, this is the substitute for the European Constitution, though it was rejected by the populations of France and Germany. How do you see the future of such agreements as you are now trying to come to with the United States in the context of this new European treaty, which does reduce the sovereignty of European nations significantly? And what role do you see NATO playing in this, and what effect can this have on European relations with Russia?
in the mist.
I don't think that the Lisbon Treaty has anything to do with my trip to the United States, or that it would relate to this trip. We signed the Lisbon Agreement with a wary heart. Unfortunately, we're not able to incorporate in that agreement everything we had originally wanted. But for me, it is just a kind of irrational compromise. For that reason, I've been a little bit sorry that the European Parliament had expressed its disappointment that a number of things had changed in regard to the former constitutional agreement. But the process is not going to be easy in our country. We never claimed that it would be easy. I think that Robert Fico thought it would go even smoother in Slovakia. I don't think that our parliament will pose any problems, but the Senate will probably turn to the Czech Court of Justice, and they will ask the Court of Justice, the Supreme Court of Justice, for its opinion on this agreement. I think that this Lisbon Treaty must be judged by the Czech Court of Justice, and I think that the Czech Court of Justice should have precedence over the European Court of Justice in matters of protection of human rights and freedoms. I think that the NATO summit, which is going to take place in Bucharest, is not going to pose any threats to the European Union. The discussion we're going to hold there is going to relate to countries such as Croatia, Albania, Macedonia, whether they are ready to join NATO, whether Ukraine and Georgia should be invited into the sort of roadmap process, and in what way the third pillar, i.e. the missile defense, should come under the umbrella of NATO. These are going to be the subjects, and I think that the EU is going to the European Union should actually concern itself with one particular issue, and that is Kosovo. Once the European Union failed already, and we cannot afford making another mistake of this kind. So I think that most of the discussions will evolve around the recognition of Kosovo, the implementation of Ahtisaari's plan, etc., etc. I don't really see a direct relation between the Lisbon Treaty and whatever has been mentioned here.
Subject of the NATO summit, Mr. Prime Minister, I wondered if you could, and undoubtedly this was some subject of your discussion with President Bush this morning, I wondered did you feel that you both had a common perspective on your hopes and aspirations for the Bucharest summit, and if not, how would you categorize your priorities for the NATO summit? What is it that you hope most to see beyond some of the things you just listed?
Well, I've already mentioned that there should be, or we should see, quite a strong statement on the third pillar of missile defense, and this is how the summit is being prepared. I think that without NATO accepting this third pillar as a part of its own defense structure, it would become very difficult for us to have it approved by the parliament. As far as the other activities are concerned, we actually discussed this in detail with President Bush, and I support both enlargements, i.e. The invitation of Georgia and Ukraine to MAP with all the risks involved, and the membership of the three mentioned countries, Croatia, Macedonia, and Albania, I believe. So I think obviously there are going to be various discussions on the importance of NATO, its role in the future, etc. So, of course, a number of issues will be discussed there. But what I do not expect any major surprises in Bucharest. So I think that it is pretty very well predictable what is going to happen in Bucharest.
Afghanistan and the NATO deployment there.
Thank you.
Well, it is a very long and painful process, and the end is not very clear, but we have to do all it takes. we really have to cooperate, we have to share responsibilities and divide responsibilities as well. But we should be slowly moving from the pure military operations to peacekeeping operations and reconstruction. So we should actually help the country to rebuild its institutions, to establish the rule of law. And obviously, if we want this country to function independently, then we really have to help them a great deal. At the end of this year, we're going to have over 500 military people present in Afghanistan. We've just started the PRT, Project Reconstruction Team, in Logar. We are cooperating with the German PRT in Faizabad. We are still present in the Kabul airport, Kaya. We've got a chemical unit there, and we also have our military hospital located in Kaya, and we're also ready to deploy our special troops as well whenever needed. I think that Afghanistan is a laboratory for future projects like that, because there are so many organizations, so many parties, so many organizations involved, and we are really building a new country. We're building civil society, we're building police forces, we're building the institutions, and the idea is, I think, to help them to build their own institutions to help themselves. As for Iraq, which is of course related to this issue, we still stay in Iraq. We're not withdrawing. We also had a very lengthy discussion with President Bush. The issue in Iraq is very similar to the one which exists between Afghanistan and Pakistan border. It is the Kurdish-Turkish or Turkish-Kurdish border where we see some problems. And for, we cannot leave Iraq. We only have to become more efficient, more effective, create conditions and lay the foundations for the reconstruction of the country. But we should not leave it. There's no way we should leave it.
Time, but we want to thank you for your candor and for your clarity in giving us a very good, I think, sense of insights and perspectives on Czech thinking about security and transatlantic relations. And we congratulate you on the signing of the MOU and movement on the visa waiver towards the visa waiver program. And we hope that you have a very successful remainder to your trip, and particularly in your meetings on Capitol Hill later today. So please join me in thanking the Prime Minister of the Czech Republic.
Once more, thank you very much, and I look forward for next meeting, and I hope I will come back to the United States, to your institution too. Thanks.